The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
You can say what you want, and you can be politically correct if you want. I don't want to be so politically correct. I like to solve problems. We have a serious, serious problem of hate. There is tremendous hate. We're large portions of a group of people, Islam.
It's radical Islam that is really, really serious and is, poses the greatest threat to us today. There isn't any question.
How many of y'all feel disrespected by Washington? That's the frustration that is boiling over.
Of course they're angry. Every institution in America has been failing us for the better part of 20 or 30 years.
We have some protesters who are bad dudes. They have done bad things. They are swinging, they are really dangerous, and they get in there and they start hitting people. And so far, I cannot believe how civil it's been up here.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. Sounds of last night's GOP presidential debate there in Miami, courtesy of CNN. It was a relatively substantive and subdued performance from all of the presidential candidates last night. Just days ahead of the next round of primaries on Tuesday, candidates dialed down the insults and actually dialed up the substance. And why? Donald Trump himself set the tone. He's in the lead. There's a chance he could all but lock up the race if he wins in both Florida and Ohio Tuesday. So Trump got traditional, doing what frontrunners do, and he tried to look presidential. Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio took their punches, yes, but their attacks weren't about Trump's business dealings or even his hands. They were about visa policy, foreign policy, Social Security. John Kasich was on the right, kind of saying, "Welcome to the party, you guys." Still, Trump's very recent incendiary statements were part of the mix. So was an assault on Wednesday at a Trump rally when a 78-year-old man named John McGraw punched a black protester in the face, then later said if he saw Rakeem Jones again, he might kill him. From his rally podium, Trump has said that in the good old days, protesters would leave on a stretcher. He's also illustrated his foreign policy pronouncements like this.
I think Islam hates us. There's something there that there's a tremendous hatred there. There's a tremendous hatred. We have to get to the bottom of it.
Now, for some Republicans, chalking up Trump's tactics and his crowd's reactions to simple economic anxiety doesn't wash anymore. Donald Trump has done enough to make them reevaluate their relationship with their grand old party. Take John William Schiffbauer. He's a self-described establishment Republican who used to be deputy communications director for New York State's GOP. But after the Super Tuesday primary and a series of Trump victories, Schiffbauer quit. He's leaving the party. There's also Evan Oxman, a Republican voter in Chicago, who says he'll probably vote for Hillary in the general election. Both John William Schiffbauer and Evan Oxman are with me now. Welcome, guys.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thank you.
John, let me start with you. Why quit?
I quit because as deputy communications director, I was in charge of running the NYGOP social media account. I was also in charge of helping draft copy and speeches, press releases for our chairman. And I knew if Trump's going to be the nominee, we're going to be having to support him one way or the other. And there was no way I was going to write copy or do social media in support of Donald Trump.
Why? You're in politics. Sometimes the figurehead of the party. You don't agree with them all the time, but it's party politics. You do your job. Why is this different?
I think it's different because I don't perceive Donald Trump as being a Republican, and I don't perceive his language as being particularly helpful to anyone other than Donald Trump.
Evan, you're there in Chicago, Illinois. What's driving you away at this point?
Well, the rhetoric, first of all, is just inflammatory and vulgar, and in addition to just being awful, doesn't seem to be winnable in the future. In addition, I'm a proud free trader, and this rhetoric of attaching 30% tariffs is, I think, disastrous. So how long do you have for all the reasons I can't stomach Trump?
So, Evan, you see protectionism growing in your party. What about racism?
Well, I think undoubtedly Trump is playing a dangerous game, not just on race, but on religion. And again, in addition to being immoral, I just think it's tactically silly, as the demographics are only going to make it harder for Republicans in the future to just win appealing to the same, you know, old white male that's traditionally supported the party.
So I take it, Evan, you're still voting in the primary, right? Who are you voting for?
Well, it's a really tough question for me, because if you had told me 6 months ago I might be voting for Ted Cruz, I would have told you you're out of your mind. But I think I'm going to wake up Tuesday and see who's in second place and vote for that person, because at this point, anything I can do to stop Trump is what I'll be doing.
And then, of course, the corollary question you're ready for, if it's a Trump-Clinton general or a Cruz-Clinton general, what do you do?
Again, if you had told me 6 months ago what I'm about to tell you, I would tell you you're crazy, but I would proudly vote for Hillary in those two scenarios. But I still hold out some hope that one of the Republican Party will come to its senses.
John William Schiffbauer, do you agree with Evan in that you're a Republican, but if it comes down to it, you're here in New York State? You got a couple of New Yorkers who could be running, Trump and Hillary Clinton.
We almost had three. Bloomberg decided not to run, of course, but I could have easily seen myself voting for Michael Bloomberg over either Hillary or Donald Trump.
Okay,
but,
you won't get that chance.
So. I know. So I'm definitely on board with Hillary at this point if it's Donald Trump or Ted Cruz at the top of the ticket.
So two Republican votes for Hillary. John, you know, I understand what you're saying, that you just couldn't do your job when you saw this rhetoric. It makes me wonder about 4 years ago and Republicans like you. When you saw your nominee, Mitt Romney, go and kiss Donald Trump's ring at the height of his birther fame, there was a message there. The message was, if you're xenophobic, if you think Barack Obama is a non-American Muslim who hates America and wasn't born here, you have a place in this Republican Party. We want your vote. That was the subtext of that endorsement. Why wasn't that enough for you? Why'd you wait till now?
I waited until now because I think there was no – I mean, Donald Trump wasn't a candidate then. I mean, it was Mitt Romney. And Donald Trump has obviously come out and made certain statements that have made it plain that he's either supporting – I mean, when he's retweeting quotes from Mussolini, that's basically an endorsement of whatever Mussolini is saying. And when he's saying, I don't know who David Duke is, I find that difficult to believe.
So, Evan, let's talk about the future of your party. As you watch all of this unfold and the Trump candidacy and the chaos within the GOP, what do you think is the best thing that can happen to your party now?
Well, I'm hoping there's a large smoke-filled room in Cleveland somewhere that can put an end to this madness. But realistically, it doesn't seem there's much that can be done. I mean, I'm hoping Tuesday is a bad day for Trump. But again, it looks increasingly unlikely. And so going forward, you know, I don't know. Will there be a third party running on a traditional Republican? I don't know. The short answer is I really don't know where we're going to go or where I'm going
to
go.
Unfortunately, Evan, I think I'm going to have to disappoint you in a huge way, just because having worked inside a party structure, I didn't work for the RNC, but I worked for the NYGOP, and I can tell you that there is not going to be a smoke-filled room in Cleveland. If there were a smoke-filled room in Cleveland, I think the grassroots would rebel huge, and I think Trump would – either way, he would come out on top, because the party establishment is just so reviled at the grassroots level at this point and has been effectively neutered on the national level.
So part of the problem, John, with what you're saying is if you engineer some way to take it away from Trump, you have to factor in that Trump has millions and millions of people who voted for him who will never vote Republican again.
Correct. And especially if he gets to 1,237 delegates, there is no way the establishment can stop him. Absolutely. Not at the convention. He's the nominee at that point.
Evan?
Well, I'm hopeful, first of all, Trump won't get to 1237, but I agree. But again, it's sort of what Lindsey Graham said. It's a choice about being poisoned or shot. I don't know which is worse.
And Evan, let me ask you about your support for Hillary Clinton, because you said proudly, and proudly is a weird word for a Republican to use about Hillary Clinton. I get voting against Donald Trump or Ted Cruz or voting against Hillary Clinton if you're a Democrat and you don't like her, but proudly voting for Hillary Clinton?
Well, perhaps I was a bit strong, but I find her so much more tolerable than either Trump or Cruz. And I think in some ways Hillary is more conservative than Trump is on certain issues. I mean, certainly I would trust Hillary more on foreign policy than I would Donald Trump.
John Schiffbauer, it seems to me the smartest thing, if Republicans could engineer this thing, which they can't, The smartest thing they could do would be to nominate Ted Cruz, the hardcore, diamond-hard conservative who nobody doubts is a Republican, even though Washington elites don't want him. Let him run and let the Republican Party fight out the real fight they're having between the right wing and the establishment guys. That would be the healthiest thing.
I think at this point, I don't think that's going to happen, but as the smart thing at this point, I don't think there is a smart thing at this point. I think the smart thing would have been to nominate Marco Rubio, but that is looking increasingly unlikely. Ted Cruz is, I mean, the best case scenario, he's Barry Goldwater, and either way we're going to lose.
But if in terms of the Goldwater analogy, yes, Goldwater loses, but Republicans win most presidential elections after that. Ted Cruz may lose, but the party will be saved. If Trump wins the nomination, he might win, but I can't see the party surviving much forward.
So it's
sort of a catch-22.
So I get the sense from both of you, you are both doing the worst thing that two Republicans can do, voting for the Democrat, and it seems like the strategy now is to scorch the earth and hope that the Republican Party can grow out of the ashes.
My suggestion would be that the Republican Senate and House campaigns would be best served by back-channeling with the Hillary Clinton campaign and trying to say, lay off, and we'll lay off of you. Because, I mean, Hillary's likable enough. So, I think we can come to terms and make deals with a second Clinton White House.
Evan Oxman, do you have a scorch-the-earth mindset right now for the GOP?
Well, I still have some, and maybe very small hope, but I have some hope that Trump will not be the nominee by hook or by crook. So I'm not ready to plan worst case scenario. But if Trump were the nominee, I think you're right. I think the hopefully he can go down in flames and the party will rise from the ashes of it.
Well, I'd say the worst case scenario for these two Republicans has already been realized. Two Republicans who say they're leaving the party in this election and voting for Hillary Clinton, John William Schiffbauer, former Deputy Communications Director for New York State's GOP, and Evan Oxman, Republican voter, at least for now, in Chicago. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. This week, a former security official with the self-proclaimed Islamic State leaked a trove of documents to German security officials and the British media, giving Westerners a new understanding of the fighters who have dedicated themselves to ISIS.
In the opinion of the security services, these documents are, in all probability, authentic. They show how conscientious this criminal organization is, and in part at least, how effective it is.
German Interior Minister Thomas Meser in a BBC translation there. The documents contain personal information for thousands of ISIS fighters. It has names, addresses, phone numbers for recruits from at least 40 countries. There has been some speculation as to the accuracy of those documents, and we're going to talk about that with Rukmini Kalamaki. She's foreign correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Welcome.
Nice to be here, Todd.
A 23-question questionnaire that you have to fill out if you want to join ISIS. What are we learning about the recruits and the fighters who are signing up?
What we're learning is that ISIS is just as bureaucratic as it promises to be. Keep in mind that Al-Qaeda as well used to have a formulaire for intake interviews of their new recruits, very similar to the one here where it asks for blood type, mother's maiden name. So ISIS seems to be continuing in that tradition.
What about ideology? There's a lot of HR type stuff in there, but they also want to know if you're loyal. They might want to know if you're willing to be a martyr.
Very similar to Al-Qaeda in that regard. I think that ISIS is very much an extension of Al-Qaeda in terms of its HR structure and its bureaucracy.
And what did we learn about the identities of some of the fighters we might have been looking for or might have been already in the media?
So far, what I'm hearing is people who have been able to look at some of these files have been able to confirm that specific fighters that they were researching, that the details regarding those fighters are correct. I haven't yet learned any details that we didn't know about these people. So for instance, one of the names that appears is Junaid Hussein, who was a very famous British member of ISIS, a suspected hacker who was killed in a drone strike a couple of months ago. So his personal details are there, and people who have studied him say that those match up. However, as you pointed out, there have been some issues regarding other aspects of the documents that have led some people to question whether they are authentic, including the fact that the flag that appears at the top of the formulaire is not the ISIS flag, which is somewhat curious.
Oh, what does that tell us? That it might have been a Photoshop or someone trying to recreate a document and they were lazy?
Well, the working theory right now is that the data is accurate. So the names of these fighters, their personal information, that part is accurate. But that somebody who was trying to sell these to an intermediary or might have been trying to sell it to the British press, which sadly is somewhat of a common practice at the border between Turkey and Syria, that they wanted to dress it up, you know, to make it look like what they thought ISIS would look like. And instead, they just made some pretty glaring stylistic errors.
Tried to throw some letterhead on there and make it look ISIS-y, in other
exactly.
words.
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
There's intelligence and then there's actionable intelligence. Mm-hmm. Does this fall into the latter category? Is this the kind of thing that our intelligence services would not have known anyway? If not, is it the kind of thing that they can act on, target people, find out more about them that they didn't already know?
I think it's more interesting from the prosecution standpoint. So, and especially for our partners in Europe, what I'm hearing from my colleague in Berlin is that they knew the names of the German members of ISIS. But because when you join ISIS, it's not necessarily something public, you know, so family members might see a Facebook post that looks suggestive. Now German officials have the names of these people and an application form that essentially states that they have joined ISIS, including a person who is on trial right now. For that suspect, this could prove to be a very useful piece of information that will lead to that person being prosecuted.
Still, there's a chance in what you're saying there that somebody here in the United States could get a knock on the door that they haven't gotten before.
I would certainly hope that our officials have identified what U.S. citizens have joined ISIS, but perhaps I'm wrong.
So, Rukmini Callimachi, what does this tell us about the value of ISIS intelligence like this, not only to British reporters who are willing to pay for it, but to others who might pick up leaks like this at the border?
Well, I can draw from my own experience. In 2013, I was covering France's military intervention in Mali, and I was able to reach the city of Timbuktu that had been occupied for almost a year by Al-Qaeda's North African branch. And what was shocking to me is that before fleeing, they had left thousands and thousands of pages of documents behind. And they hadn't bothered really, you know, to either pick them up or to destroy them. And they were literally there for journalists like me to pick up. And that trove of documents that I was able to obtain in 2013 has forever changed my understanding of Al-Qaeda. And what I learned from that experience is that these groups are very bureaucratic. They have to be because they have thousands of fighters. They have limited resources, so they need to marshal their finances in the best possible way, which leads to receipts, which leads to accounting, which leads to expense reports. And all of that involves paper. And when they're fleeing, they generally don't have a good enough structure in place to get rid of their paper trail. And that paper trail, as soon as it's discovered by reporters, leads to insight into the group. And it's one of their security failures, you know, that they need this paper to run the other organization. And therefore, the paper trail then becomes a way for us to have a window into this terror group.
HR documents may be a bureaucratic leak from ISIS. New insights into how the terrorist organization operates in Iraq, Syria, and other countries. Rukmini Callimachi, foreign correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. And the partisan battle over the next Supreme Court nominee is already playing into Senate races in states where Republicans are seen as vulnerable, places like Illinois and Wisconsin and New Hampshire. But there are surprising developments in Iowa, where Senate Judiciary Chair Chuck Grassley is up for re-election himself. Now, Grassley has lined up with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and pledged to block any Supreme Court nominee President Obama should send their way, from even getting a hearing. Here was Grassley at the Senate Judiciary Committee on Thursday.
We're not going to drop any nominee into an election year cauldron, and I'm certainly not going to let it happen to the good people of Iowa.
Now, Democrats are trying to use the politics of this standoff to their advantage as they try to retake the Senate in 2016, of course. But now there are signs that the usually very popular Chuck Grassley is going to have a fight on his hands himself back in Iowa. One week ago, the former Iowa Lieutenant Governor Patty Judge announced she is throwing in to challenge Grassley in November, and she's got the national backing of the Democratic Party behind her. With me now to discuss how all of this is affecting Grassley's chances in Iowa, Jason Noble. He's a political reporter with the Des Moines Register. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
So what are the signs that Chuck Grassley might really have a real fight on his hands this year?
Well, I don't know if we've seen the data yet that truly sort of shows that he is vulnerable. But Democrats are certainly seeing an opening here with the Supreme Court fight and just how central Grassley is to it. Like you said in the intro, Patty Judge, very kind of late in this process, has jumped into this race and looks like she's going to have strong backing from the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee and kind of the D.C. campaign establishment.
I mean, Chuck Grassley is one of the biggest political names anywhere, but Patty Judge is well known too?
Yeah, this definitely sets up a much bigger battle in the state of Iowa. Chuck Grassley, for decades, has been the most popular politician in the state of Iowa, highly respected not only by Republicans but also independents. And you probably get a lot of Democrats that grudgingly tell you that they like the job he's doing too. But Patty Judge has run and won 3 times on the statewide ticket. She's certainly a known quantity to Iowa voters in a way that the other challengers on the Democratic side who had stepped up against Grassley just aren't at this point.
So Grassley's got 36 years in the Senate, and that's usually enough to make somebody invulnerable. Is that the case in Iowa, or is he vulnerable on the grounds that a lot of other people are vulnerable? It's an anti-incumbent year shaping up.
I don't think so. He kind of embodies Iowa political values, or he has for a long time. And so it's going to take something really seismic to change that with him. I talked to Patty Judge a week ago. She said the 2 things that kind of went into the calculation here were the Supreme Court controversy and the potential for Donald Trump at the top of the Republican ticket.
And what kind of press, though, is Chuck Grassley getting from the editorial boards and from the news outlets in Iowa about this political standoff over the Supreme Court?
It's been very critical, probably in a way that he has not experienced in a long time, if ever. Editorial boards have been pining on this, saying that he needs to give a nominee a hearing, criticizing his handling of it. And of course, the Democratic Party here in the state has been broadcasting those opinions far and wide as much as they can.
And in terms of Patty Judge, sometimes these challenges to popular incumbents are kind of vanity runs. Do we know whether Democrats are going to pour serious money and serious resources behind her?
We have every indication at this point that she is going to have a lot of support from what I guess you would call kind of the national campaign establishment. The question is, though, whether the grassroots are going to be behind her. There is a state senator here who's been in this race for over a year, who's got a lot of support. There may be a little friction here between the guy who decided to make a run at Chuck Grassley when it was hard and Patty Judge, former lieutenant governor, who's going to have all this backing from Washington trying to take him on at this late date. There's a primary in June.
Jason Noble, political reporter for the Des Moines Register. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Todd.
There's a new comedy series called The Characters premiering on Netflix today. Its creators say it's outlaw comedy. 8 up-and-coming comedians are told to break the rules. Each gets a 30-minute episode where they can do whatever they want. These comedians write and star in their own performances, but there is only one rule. They can't be themselves. They have to perform as all the other characters they've been dreaming up. John Early is one of those lucky 8, and our friend and comedian Jolenta Greenberg sat down with Early and talked about how he channels his characters like Jason the youth pastor and a Southern comedian named Vicky.
Every draft I turned in, I was just waiting for them to say, absolutely not. I mean, I remember sitting in my apartment 3 years ago dreaming of a special that was formatted exactly like this. But I was like, but I have to be a superstar in order for anyone to ever let me do this. And then this like truly fell in my lap.
Why do you think this doesn't happen more? Is it just a risk reward benefit thing?
I think it's just we're, you know, on the brink of this thing where there is just truly so much content and there are so many platforms for content. So I think executives, they feel like they're in the wild, wild west and are throwing their hands up and being like, oh, God, like you do it. Comedians are being, in America at least, I think, are being snatched up left and right. It's really a good time to be someone who's into like producing, writing your own stuff. And also it's, you know, it's like the YouTube generation. They picked a bunch of people who have found their voice and developed their voice in a space of total creative freedom.
What was your process like then? You spoke of it a little bit. How did you cultivate the characters? How did you choose which ones to highlight?
I definitely was like, well, if this is going to be your big kind of introduction on the widest platform yet, do what you're really, really good at. Do the stuff you've been – like I've been doing Vicky, the Southern comedian, in my show for a few years. And she is really just an amalgamation of all the Southern women I grew up mm-hmm. with in Asheville, mm-hmm. you know, and Jason, the like youth pastor character.
It said in your profile that you're a youth pastor.
For sure, yeah.
What age kids do you work with?
9 to 11.
Oh, cool age. It's a good age.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite ages in terms of their playful spirits.
I've been doing him in my shows for years, and he's a big old – I love doing him. So I really just took the things that I felt like were my favorite places to be in, and also knowing that this was going to be a quick, dirty shoot. I was like, I need to pick things I'm comfortable with.
And I think most of your characters seem to be sort of riffs on your typical gender norms, mm-hmm. Like Vicky, like Vicky with the V.
My husband and I were going out to dinner night. I walked outside. I was feeling a little chilly. I was just wearing a halter. I said, honey, I'm going to run inside real quick, grab my denim. He said, honey, we don't have time. I made reservations at Maggiano's at 7:30. It's 7:15 right now. It's going to take 25 minutes to get there. It's going to put us at 10 minutes late. I said, honey, it's not going to take me but 1 minute to run inside real quick and grab my denim. What's one more minute going to mean to the fine people at Maggiano's? He said, honey, I'm serious. You get in the car right now. I said, honey, I'm serious. I'm looking for my denim.
Yes, Vicky. Oh, I love her. So you take on these stereotypes and you heighten them and stretch them, and they sort of turn into these fun house images. Are they departures from yourself, and is that why you like exploring it? Or are these people inside John and you're just letting them out?
I definitely think they're all inside me. It's never that conscious, but I do, when I'm like sitting there editing it, I'm like, oh, wow, this is so transparent. Like, you know, I just like Jason to me is just me giving myself the opportunity to be totally dumb. And the anal retentive gay guy is absolutely me, you know, throwing a party. It's like I've never had a party where I haven't been completely racked with terror. So that is it's totally me.
Jason, who you were mm-hmm. just talking about, is a youth pastor, and he seems to be like very clearly a closeted gay man who also isn't too sharp.
Yep.
Is religion important to you? Do your parents, who are both pastors, mm-hmm. how do they feel about your riffs on religion?
They are so game for it. I'm so lucky. They come to all my shows, like my stand-up shows, where I'm very explicitly sexual and I talk about just fully not believing in God, and they're cracking up more than anyone else. You know, I think they're a great example of like what it means to be religious but also actually open-minded about other perspectives.
All right. Well, thank you so much for talking to us about your new project, John.
Thanks for having me.
You can see John in the characters when it premieres on Netflix, and you can always see him on Twitter at @BJohnse.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, Hal. Do you read me?
Oh, my.
Have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
We're not hosting an intergalactic kegger down here.
What the hell's wrong with freedom, man? That's what it's all about.
Why do you think I'm calling you? Just to say hello?
I gotta tell you, we did suicide missions in the Army that had better odds than this.
Friday is the day when we talk about the weekend's new movie releases. Of course, as always, Rafer Guzman is here to weigh in. He's the film critic for Newsday. Hi, Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
Great to have you. We've got a couple of films this week. We've got 10 Cloverfield Lane starring John Goodman and Brothers Grimsby with Sacha Baron Cohen. Let's start with the Brothers Grimsby, Sacha Baron Cohen. I saw a commercial where he promises the most confusing and nonsensical plot you can imagine.
He has delivered. This is Sacha Baron Cohen playing a football hooligan who is the estranged brother of Mark Strong, who is a MI6 spy, and the two of them reunite.
Let's listen to a clip.
You need to head inside, find Lena Schmidt, and seduce her.
What, and cheat on Donna? Never.
You need to seduce her in order to find out what Lukashenko bought from her husband.
Okay.
Can you see Lena Schmidt? She's easy to spot. She's wearing a green dress and she's absolutely gorgeous.
She is gorgeous.
Now, of course, the joke there, which you can't quite see, is that the woman in the green dress, there's another woman in the green dress who is Gabourey Sidibe. And, you know, Sacha Baron Cohen, being this kind of low-class football hooligan, falls for the large woman in the green dress rather than the pretty slender one in the other green dress. Now, that is kind of, to me, emblematic of where this film is going. I love Sacha Baron Cohen. He's an incredible talent, brave as hell and very funny. But he's also got a mean streak, and I think it comes out here. There's a lot of fat jokes, a lot of very gross jokes. A lot of the humor just seems very mean, especially toward the football hooligan community that he is kind of trying to represent and trying to get us to know and love. But I think he just really mocks them as scuzzballs and these kind of low-class types in England. And it doesn't work. And I think especially in America, where you sort of have a passing familiarity with that culture, and if you'd kind of like Sacha Baron Cohen to make us embrace it and love it, love those guys and kind of root for them, but he doesn't. And the film feels very vulgar and very mean-spirited to me.
Is there at least some guilty laughter in it? You're laughing, but you feel bad for doing it?
You know, he has a. There are some funny jokes. You know, where you know his son is smoking cigarettes, and he takes the cigarettes away from him and says, "You know, at your age, you should just be vaping." And there's a few little things like that.
Yeah, like that.
It's not enough to really hold your attention for the length of a comedy.
All right, so you may have given the best of it right there in that commentary. Let's move on to 10 Cloverfield Lane. This is a horror movie. It has John Goodman and Mary Elizabeth Winstead.
What are you going to do to me?
I'm going to keep you alive. You were in an accident, and I saved your life by bringing you here. Everyone outside of here is dead.
What happened to your arm? Were you trying to escape?
I was trying to get in.
Rafer, I like it when actors show up in new genres. You know, this is not playing a quirky character in a Coen Brothers comedy anymore for John Goodman. This is a straight-up horror film.
This is much more Kathy Bates in Misery. He's got Mary Elizabeth Winstead trapped in this bunker, and it's a great sort of fiendishly simple premise. You know, he's not a crazy guy. He's actually saved her. The world has been attacked, and the air is unbreathable, and she must stay inside with him. And so basically most of the film is her trying to figure out, is this guy telling me the truth? Great role for John Goodman. He goes from hot to cold in an instant. He's a lot of fun, and he's the guy who keeps this all very interesting. As you may know, this is sort of the not quite a sequel, sort of a follow-up slash spin-off to Cloverfield, the sci-fi film from 2008. I don't want to spoil any more, but I will say that while it is kind of related, it could totally stand on its own, and it's a great, tense little claustrophobic thriller like Panic Room or like Wait Until Dark, if you remember that movie. Great little economical thriller that's a lot of fun with a lot of twists and turns.
So is this kind of like if Walter Sobchak was serious and mad?
that's basically what it is. And you can't tell, you know, is he a psycho? Is he a nice guy? Is he telling the truth? Could it be all three? You know, it's very interesting and a lot of fun.
So there it is, one positive review for 10 Cloverfield Lane with John Goodman, and a negative one this week for The Brothers Grimsby with Sacha Baron Cohen. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today, and we return now to a conversation we've been having with you all week long about gentrification in American cities. Earlier, I talked with Rebecca Carroll. She's the producer for special projects on race at WNYC and a reporter for the new podcast, There Goes the Neighborhood. That's a collaboration between our co-producer, WNYC, and The Nation magazine. We've gotten so many comments from listeners like you all across the U.S., both gentrified and the gentrifying. And I asked Rebecca the question that came up in Kansas City just a moment ago. What does an ideal neighborhood look like?
So it's hard to describe the ideal neighborhood without sounding like, you know, let's all get in a circle and sing together. But truthfully, I mean, I think it should be a place that is representative of the country. And that means black and brown faces. That means white faces. That means a vast array of folks who are in different types of jobs and careers. And, you know, that is truly properly diverse.
Here's a text we got from right here in New York City. I want to read it for you. It's gentrifying as I text this, and it's very unpleasant. I was part of the creative class wave that stabilized the area, but we didn't pay much either and certainly didn't push anyone out. Now that there is so much development, it's becoming increasingly newcomer-centric and insufferable. I'm thinking of selling and moving. Rebecca Carroll, your reaction to that.
So that is so interesting. I mean, the idea of the creative class, which is a term that was coined by the Toronto economist Richard Florida some years back.
Starving artists moving in.
But it's basically, I mean, the creative class are the kind of the pioneers, the visionaries of gentrification. Artists with cultural savvy who are drawn to areas that have energy and a kind of diversity of color and race and ethnicity and a beat and a, you know, something, a pulse. And so, you know, mostly, I'm not going to say all, but primarily white, who come to these neighborhoods and are drawn to that diversity, but then rebrand it. So creative class are the folks who create the gorgeous packaging of the artisanal chocolate. You know what I mean? These are the folks who turn the neighborhood into a stylized neighborhood as opposed to a properly diverse neighborhood.
Well, does this then mean that gentrification is strictly in the eye of the beholder? The creative class doesn't view themselves as the gentrifier because they're creative, they're down with the vibe of the neighborhood. As soon as somebody follows them, all of a sudden, the soul of the neighborhood is gone.
They're down with the vibe of the neighborhood, but they also know how to monetize that vibe and monetize it in a way that is attractive to people who then are these kind of newcomer-centric and insufferable folks.
So many of our callers, I think, are also sort of struggling with what exactly this is. We got a lot of calls about the difference between gentrification versus revitalization. Listen.
Hi, my name is Danette from Hinesville, Georgia, and I believe that gentrification is a four-letter word. People that have lived in their communities for decades and own the property that they live in, but maybe not the land, are losing things that they've worked so hard to maintain. There should be a balance between revitalizing a neighborhood and keeping the people that make the neighborhood vibrant and beautiful and whole.
I would venture to say that Annette probably agrees with you.
So that's pretty extraordinary. I mean, this echoes almost exactly, you know, what I have said here and in conversation and in making this podcast. Revitalization and urban renewal happens in cities across the country. There are still folks who have been in a home for long enough so that it feels like displacement. It feels like upheaval. That's really all that matters, you know, whether or not this is inevitable or it's bound to happen. There has to be a way to sort of manage and be mindful of people who are having this experience.
At the same time, I keep offering you counterexamples. Of course, we heard from Daniel in Chico, California, who said that gentrification has been good in his neighborhood. He said it's been very positive. Property values have gone up. Crime from drugs and human trafficking is down. I have a very positive take on that.
And I think that that is great. And I think that that obviously serves him. I would feel concerned about, more concerned about the people it does not serve, which is to say the people who were driven out before the revitalization happened, the people who lived there where when the drugs were still being sold, when there was still violence, when there was less commerce, when there was less opportunity.
Rebecca Carroll, one of sort of the key parts of this constant debate over gentrification is race and also economics. There are laws of nature when it comes to economics, one of which is people will go where the rent is cheap. That's the way it is. It's like a bird eating a worm. We heard from Sean, and I want to play you his call.
My name is Sean Rosvold. I'm calling from Colorado Springs, Colorado. I lived in Crown Heights, Brooklyn from 2005 until 2011. Moving there, we were some of the few white people in the neighborhood. We got stopped walking down the street, black people asking us what we were doing there. We never considered it a race issue at all. We considered it an economic issue. It was an affordable house. And we moved in.
It was affordable. We moved in. But was Sean sort of blind to the fact that economics and race can sometimes be two sides of the same coin?
Well, totally blind. I mean, he says it himself. We never considered it a race issue at all. So that's how nice that he didn't have to consider it a race issue when the people who lived there, it's always a race issue. It's easy to say it's about economics. It's easy to say it's an affordable place. I can afford it. I'm going to move in. Again, race, though, stands alone in that no matter whether people of color have money or don't have money, they're still black people. Or termed, you know, here as black people who are stopping and questioning what this white guy is doing in their community. He sounded to me like unnerved by that.
Who wouldn't be unnerved by that? If somebody had just bought a house or rented a house and was walking down their block, even if they're not prepared for what they're doing in that neighborhood, who wouldn't be unnerved by being stopped by people who say, what are you doing here? I think that would unnerve any person.
Okay, sure. Fair enough. Somebody who did some research about the neighborhood they're moving into, an historically black neighborhood, and suddenly white people are moving in. there is anxiety around that for all of the historical reasons, race in America, and for, you know, the direction that neighborhoods are changing. So I think, you know, be that as it may, if he was unnerved by that, but I think that the person who wouldn't be unnerved by that is a person who took some time to think about sort of plopping themselves in the space without entering the community.
Well, we hope that this continuing conversation on gentrification and race helps to serve that very purpose. Rebecca Carroll is producer of special projects on race at WNYC. She's a reporter for the new podcast, There Goes the Neighborhood. That's a collaboration between our co-producer, WNYC, and The Nation magazine. Rebecca, thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me.
And here's something to take with you today. In the 16 years that it's been on the air, the contestants on CBS's Survivor haven't had to worry too much about actually, you know, surviving. But that all changed last night when three contestants collapsed in 100-plus degree heat in the Cambodian jungle, and one had to be rushed to a nearby hospital.
All right, let's go. We need water. Water, water.
You're all right, Caleb. We're right here, all right? Medical's with us.
Let's go. Put some on him.
Our partner, the New York Times, called it, quote, genuinely terrifying television. But Survivor host Jeff Probst told the Times that, quote, this won't be the last evacuation they have. Just be careful out there, guys. Have fun. It's reality television, but not too much reality. Okay, thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. You can always find me on Twitter at Todd Zwillick, and you can tweet me there. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and from Staples, with printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.